Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, 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 hello. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. My name is Alex Q, and welcome to episode 2.3 of Christmas Cast.
Hey.
I like to move it, move it. I like to move it, move it. To move it, move it. I like to
move it.
Oh my lord, that was the worst. That was the worst add on to the actual right. So, if anyone would like to be a new superstar co-host on Miscast, there's suddenly a new opening just opened up. So, do send your applications to the Miscast Twitter feed and you can be the new co-host. That was terrible. Anyway, so this is the podcast where each episode, using the expertise of my superstar co-hosts, ish and special guest, we will discuss tabletop topics that we hope will help improve your generalship expertise and enjoyment of your gaming experience. It's the podcast that talks nonsense, and that's it. And it's the podcast that's been trying to save Christmas elves this week.
Oh,
it's that sort of podcast. So save obviously them. It's Christmas.
Save them obviously. From what?
So you know when you go to like shopping malls or like just general shops like John Lewis, and they have the Santa's Grossos now. And the Santas are always like super up for it. Like just, yeah, awesome Christmas. But the little like shop elves that they've just grabbed some random staff member to be an elf. The ones we walked past on Oxford Street the other day genuinely looked like they wanted to kill themselves.
How did you save them?
Oh, I offered them a thing of mulled wine and a hot chocolate, which then saved them from the actual queue, and they just seemed really relieved to just not be sat there having children kick their shins constantly.
Mulled wine helps most situations, to be fair.
I think...
Mulled wine and... Yeah, sorry, Owen.
Just elves have been OP for ages, so fuck them.
Do you think that's what I should have said? I should have leaned into it and said, elves are OP, fuck yeah, you.
Exactly. Tell Techless to suck one.
Oh, brilliant.
You're a fan then, obviously, Owen.
All two yeah, so anyway. Blizzard, you bastards.
Well, I mean, these elves were not very OP. They just had the, you know, they make them have like red cheeks and like really pointy ears and shit. And they just generally just look like they wanted to die. I mean, I know because I did a part-time job in a very famous UK store. Selling light bulbs at Christmas, and I swear to God, the Christmas music started at the start of November, right through to halfway through Jan, and oh my word,
That's too much.
If I heard the "It's Christmas" one more time, I would have hung someone with a light bulb.
Not a fan. It's impossible. Not a fan of Noddy Holder, then, no.
Oh, it was fine at the start, but when you've heard it for like 80 times in a row, it's a bit like torture.
Mm. What's your favourite Christmas song then, Alex?
Oh, that's a good question. That is a really good question.
We're way off script here, aren't we?
It's like the pose for me, right? And the other day, we're driving along, the Pose comes on, Alex turns it up, and I went, "Oh, that you turned that up quick." And she looked round at me and went, "Well, they're both dead now, aren't they?" That's the reason.
And Merry Christmas to you too, Alex.
I like Chris Rea driving home at Christmas. That's always a good one.
That's a classic one. Do you know the first one that literally popped into my head was E17. Stay now, baby, if you got that one.
Alex. Did our guest David Hasselhoff's quite big in Germany, isn't he? did he do a Christmas tune?
There are some German Christmas songs, but most of the time we just have the English ones on all the time as well.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Which is quite annoying. Yeah. I guess my favorite Christmas song is actually Christmas Tues from Sabaton, which is a metal band. But
you go hardcore Christmas.
Well, it's not hardcore. It's quite emotional because it's about Christmas truce in First World War between Germans and, I guess, French and British. Yeah. So that's emotional.
Football, right? Is that right?
Less annoying.
That's a story. They played football on Christmas Day.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And we lost on penalties.
Yeah, so.
We did lose on penalties, yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that was only in one year of the war, whereas in the next year, the generals noticed that basically in the next year they were just killing each other.
Savage.
Well, there you go. Some music highlights for the listeners. I like that. Maybe we should change this into a music podcast. Mariah Carey actually is probably my real answer because, I mean, it's classic, right?
Old five octave Carey, yeah. She's, that's a pretty Christmas standard. What am I bored? I've listened to a lot of Holly Jolly Christmas this year, I think. I hosted a Christmas party for the first time in ages.
Oh, really?
Yes. In Brooklyn, which was fun, and we listened to like lots of Christmas crooning. Anyway, I've also indoctrinated lots of people into playing Warhammer. There were lots of guests who were like, "Yeah, I used to do that when I was a kid." I'm starting a new little Warhammer club in Brooklyn. So, any listeners who are Brooklyn based,
you could do street Warhammer in Brooklyn. You could just like, was it Bobo? You guys did that?
Yeah. I lost to Jack Armstrong because I was pissed, and he took all my toys, literally.
wasn't that playing with like a starting box and then
I had the Ogre Moor Tribes one, so I had a really good one, and Jack smashed me up with some undead, and then if you lost a round you gave your toys to the to your opponent.
Wow. that's your future, Owen. That's what's coming up.
Okay, all right, fine, I can deal with that.
Just don't play down it before the rounds and you'll be fine.
Right, enough of this nonsense. Let's do some intros.
Okay, go on then.
So, you've heard the first co-host Sexy Serenades. He hasn't screamed out pervert or football for a while, actually, so I probably need to change the intro. He goes by at Positive Victim on X. It's Darren Watson.
Ooh.
Hey, Darren. Hi, Darren.
Hello, Darren.
That was a very subdued, woo. Yay! How are you?
I'm grand. I've got three excellent Darren and Alex stories.
Please,
like them. I told
Let's
you.
Let's go.
Them.
It's Christmas. It's only fair.
I whiz through them, but they are. I think they're hilarious. So, what's the first one? So, the first one was I have been doing a lot of stuff over eBay for Rick Myhill and Ryan. The premise being, I'm selling their shit on eBay and I get a cut. So, I was taking my most recent load down there, 10 parcels, and Alex will come with me to the post office and she'll walk Freddie, our dog. It's about 5-10 minutes away. And then when I'm in the post office, she will walk around the block, and hopefully by the time she's back round, I'm done posting the packages. So I she fucks off. I go in, I post my packages. I come out and I can see that she's just come around the corner and she's just crossing the road. And I wave at her. And she's carrying, she's got Freddie on the left side on the leash, and then she's carrying a dog shit on the other. And then just crossing the road. And as she's crossing the road, there's a gentleman, a short gentleman, like he must be in his 50s, behind her, also crossing the road. And you kind of like, when you're crossing the road, you hurry up, don't you, a little bit, because a car was coming to turn into the road. But just as I've started to wave, Alex has forgot she's carrying a dog shit, and she's waved back at me, and she's hit him in the head with a dog shit. It was like watching a car crash. It was just perfect. So that's the first one.
Hang on. Was he covered or was he?
No. Okay, it was in a bag, but you don't expect to like cross the road
just and be slapped in the face.
Shit, do you?
Yeah, that's fair enough. Okay.
So that's brilliant. Okay.
So that's the first one.
We'd been to Devon at some point, and we stayed in a B&B, and we came across, we were really impressed. They've got, you know, when you get in there and they've all got the teas and everything set out, they had these cups that were big enough to dunk an entire biscuit in. And we've not had mugs big enough to dip an entire biscuit in for a long time. So we were quite excited. So we were like, right, we must go out and treat ourselves. Every month we do something to improve our lives. So like, that month, it would have been last month, it would have been to find some mugs that are big enough to dip an entire rich tea biscuit in, or a hobnob for Alex. So we were in B&M and we both picked up a mug that we thought would be good enough. And then we mimicked, without thinking about it, both mimicked putting an entire biscuit in the tea.
Did you not take a biscuit with you just to check?
No, we're not that organized.
Yeah.
So we've been together almost 11 years now, and we don't finish each other's sentences. We say the same thing. That's how fucking long we've been together. But now it's starting to manifest itself physically, where on cue we're doing the same thing. So in that very same shop last week, we were queuing up for some candles, because it's so fucking cold here, we're not putting on the heating. We're using candles to heat ourselves up because we're saving.
Like a Victorian family. Yeah.
So okay. we're in the queue in B&M for these candles, and it's fucking absolutely freezing, and I'm not sure which one of us started doing it, but one of us started like bobbing up and down, you know, when you're cold you bob up and down. So then like the pair of us are bobbing up and down in unison, and then we both go into like a trance like state in the queue. And you know when you get that feeling someone's watching you? I got like this feeling someone's, and I look up and the cashier is just looking straight at us. She goes, "You two quite all right?"
We're bobbing up and down like psychopaths in the
So, and then the third one, I'll tell you how I almost died recently. This is shocking. So we've been together, like I say, a very long time, and people that have been in long-term relationships, you probably relate to this. There's always that one thing that might end your relationship, and I know what it is for Alex. It's that I put too much food in my mouth when I eat. It really fucks her off. Anyway, we're watching Taskmaster, and she's made some vegan meatballs and pasta for us. And I always chop my meatballs in half so that I can distribute them throughout the entire meal. You know, I'll put a meatball, have a load of pasta, mushrooms, cheese, pretend cheese, pop it all in my mouth. And I'm chewing on this mouthful, and I'm thinking to myself, I swear I put a meatball on that fork. And just as I had that thought, something makes me laugh on Taskmaster. And I'm like, all right, that's where the meatball is. And it's gone straight down my throat.
Oh, my God.
And the first sort of like 10 seconds, I just put my hands on the table and I'm like, I can breathe a little bit. So I'm not panicking, but I can't speak. And I'm trying to work it down. And Alex is looking at me like this. like I'm some sort of, like I'm some sort of idiot. She's like, what are you doing? You know, I know exactly what's going in her head.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
After 10 seconds, it lodges down a bit further, and it's I can't breathe at all. So okay. I'm not panicking because I'm asthmatic. So I'm used to like not being able to breathe. And I'm also thinking, yeah. And I'm also thinking to myself, right, I'm choking. Let's not panic because that's not going to help the situation. But then it gets to about, I don't know, 20 seconds, 25 seconds in, and Alex is still not helping me. She's still looking at me like, hello. So I start banging the table like, fucking, this is serious stuff. And then she breaks out of her trance and then starts like bashing my back. And it's still not working. And at this point, she realizes it's serious because now I start spluttering pasta all over the table. So she's really whacking my back and I'm whacking my front of my chest and I still can't breathe. I then start at this point, about 40 seconds, 50 seconds in, I start to panic. So I get up and I bent and I'm beating my chest and then I bend over. And as I bend over, I vomit a load of pasta onto the floor. And then Freddie immediately comes and eats it. Like, I'm thinking, Freddie, fuck off, I'm dying here, what are you doing? But Alex has this clever idea that like, I'm bent over. She's like, oh, I've seen this in the movies, I'm going to try the Heimlich maneuver. So she comes up behind me as I'm bent over. Now you're supposed to be stood up, aren't you, for the Heimlich maneuver, and you're supposed to like
you lift up
he does it whilst I'm bent over, right? So she basically spends, I don't know, 25 seconds dry humping me. And it's at this point, I must be about a minute 20 into not breathing. I'm going slightly mad, but I have this moment of clarity where I think to myself, this is it. I'm going to die. How absurd. The last thing I'm going to see is a dog eating my sick. The last thing I'm going to experience is my fiance dry humping the fuck out of me.
Right. And a half of meatballs killed you. And
I find it so funny that dislodges it. I laugh.
Oh, you're literally laughing. It just laughs out.
Exactly. So, like, laughter killed me and saved me all within 2 minutes. And then afterwards, we sat back down and watched the rest of Taskmaster, and we didn't speak to each other for 8 minutes. And I just went, that was fucking weird, wasn't it? It's the most surreal. Oh, that's the highlight of my year. That is...
Well, I mean, I'm very happy you didn't die from a meal.
Yeah, so am I. But I thought that was it. I'm dead. I'm
wowzers.
Gone.
Maybe you should, for a Christmas present, you guys should go to a first aid course and learn how to do Heimlich.
Learn how to do the Heimlich maneuver. Just, yeah,
interesting.
I'm going to peg him to death. This is my moment. Fuck him.
That'd be quite a good comedy sketch, actually. Just someone just dry humping you as a dog just eats the rest of your pasta.
Oh, yeah, God, it was just so obscene.
Well, I am very glad you're still alive, Darren. But I would have visited your gravestone with some half-eaten meatballs if it had happened.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, dear. Right. Well, thanks for that, Darren. That was great. Owen, how are you going with that one?
I thought you'd like that.
Right. Let's right. We're going to just have to get onto the next one, then, aren't we?
I think so.
Right. You guys know our second host. He's the sexy sock seductor himself. You can find him at "Ooh, that's a lovely bit of sockling" on Instagram.
Jesus Christ.
He's at OJ180 on X. It's the Owen Jackson, everyone.
Yeah.
Hi, Owen. Good luck following Darren. any dry humping?
No comment.
Us?
No, none of no. I can't relate to any of those stories. I liked your story of about the Yuletide log, though. That was good, Darren. The dog log in the bag.
The what?
The dog log.
Oh,
dog,
yeah.
He
yeah.
means the dog poo.
Yeah.
I was trying to bring it back to being festive. No, I'm good. Thank you, Alex.
And you were telling us off mic, you're in USA, USA, USA. Yeah.
Yeah, I like it over here. It's great. They eat loads of food. I like food. So, yeah, I've been eating a lot of food, playing quite a reasonable amount of Warhammer, played in a couple of tournaments. And hanging out with my girlfriend over here. So, yeah, and family. So, yeah, having a good time. slowed
down.
You
went to Everwinter, and what was the other one you went to?
Du Bois.
Du Bois.
Ah, Du Bois. Yeah, but that was fun. Mind you, yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, because they're both quite close to each other, then I got quite a feel for the local meta. A lot of people come over the border from Canada, and then the Northeast, you know, has got quite a big gaming community. And then certainly for Everwinter, quite a few people came over from like the West Coast, and Gavin was there from like the Texas area. And so it's kind of, yeah, I've got a pretty good steer on the US scene.
A lot of Destruction players?
Quite a few Destruction players. I played, yeah, that's actually at Du Bois. I played Big Wah 3 times.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
All the bigs.
Not an easy thing with beasts.
Not anymore.
Americans living up to their stereotypes, then, eh? Obviously.
I think it's a really good army. I think this might be the first Warhammer reference. What are we, half an hour in? Mm. So, yeah.
That's about right. That's fast for us.
Sounds about right, yeah. But, yeah, I played against Big War a few times, which was good. I think they're a really good army, actually. I'm quite intrigued to maybe play them myself. Mm. But, yeah, been pushing my beasts of chaos around.
Your beastly beasts, the same beastly beasts you were using before, the little two sixes.
I think I've settled on a list now which I really like. I've been playing a big blob of 30 Ungol Raiders, which I quite like to bop around the board with Dark War, because you can put them around and you get a lot of value out of +1 to hit with them. But I still think beasts is an interesting army. You trade a lot on a lot. It doesn't come up that often. Like, people, you know, it's not a very popular army, I don't think. So it has quite a lot of value. And talking about movement, I was thinking about it in relation to beasts. And with dropping down...
There isn't any.
No, exactly. So I've got nothing to add to this conversation, because the army I currently play either teleports or deep strikes and charges.
You have, actually. The play that I'm going to mention has got some movement shenanigans.
Spoilers. Spoilers. But yeah,
feeling pretty chilled, and like it's the end of the year, kind of, you know, you get into that reflective mode.
Yeah,
Darren, I haven't said it, but you're looking really well, mate.
Thank you. I put into looking well, and I'm really hungover. So,
oh, great.
I haven't had a drink for a very long time, and last night we do like a binge every year at our friends, so we pretend we're like Romans. Not with a vomitarian or anything, but we just eat what we want all day long, and we drink all day long once a year.
Right.
And I've been trying to lose weight and improve my health this year. That was my focus. So I've not really eaten since June because I've been intermittent fasting. So it was a fucking brilliant day.
A day of gluttony, right?
Yeah.
You've got to be careful you don't choke on it, though, Darren.
No, Alex is just watching me constantly.
Yeah, chew your food, young man. When you get to the end of the year, you look back at what's happened and what's going to happen and things like that. So feeling pretty happy and reflective and
good
life and gaming and everything.
And jazz.
Yeah, not really. Echo doesn't like jazz.
I know.
I've been putting on some jazz Christmas albums. There's a really good Snoopy Christmas album, which is like this kind of New York jazz. It doesn't sound like it's your jam, I must say, Toby.
As in Snoop Dogg or as in the cartoon dog?
No, as in the cartoon dog, as in Snoopy and Peanuts and stuff.
I was hoping for a hybrid of both.
That one.
Yeah. there's a jazz Christmas record which is going to get an airing, I think, over the next 24 hours.
Okay.
48 hours.
Hasn't old Snoop Dogg recently given up weed?
Yeah, but then I heard that was just a promotion, because he was like promoting like a smokeless coal barbecue, so he went smokeless and then
it's all an ad thing.
Yeah, he's back on the bong.
Back on the bong.
Yes, so in short, my friends, I am well. Thank you very much.
Very good. Good. I'm glad to hear it. Also, just talking about reflecting on the past 20 minutes of this podcast, we've gone from Darren nearly dying to Snoop Dogg's giving up weed. I mean, we cover everything in this podcast. So. Yeah,
very diverse.
Yeah, indeed. Diverse podcast. Right. Let's get our lovely, sexy special guest in, shall we?
Yes.
Our lovely guest today is not only an international superstar, he is actually the captain of Team Germany and AOS coach. Unfortunately, though, one of the first players he met was actually Luke Morton, so we do have to all apologise to Toby. Toby doesn't really use Twitter, but he does have a Twitter handle, which is at AOS Toby. Sorry, X handle. It's Toby, everyone.
Yeah.
Hello.
Woo!
Yay. Finally. Knock some sense into us, young man.
Toby. Thanks very much for coming on.
Thank you for
having
me. How
are you doing, Toby? You're all good? All ready for Christmas?
I'm good. Ready for Christmas? Not sure. I'm not too big of a Christmas person, to be honest.
Fair enough.
But ready for holidays, I would say.
So you finished work and you're all off now. You're good. You got a bit of time off.
Yeah. Well, three or four days, basically. I have off.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for coming on and talking to us. As you guys might have guessed from the title that my co-host absolutely fucked up at the start, this is about movement.
Yay.
This episode's about movement. So thank you to, I think it was Sean and Noah for suggesting this. We sent a tweet out asking what you, the listener, would like to listen to.
Yeah.
And this was the first suggestion. It got most likes to say people want to hear about some movement.
I hear you've been practicing your slat drops, Alex.
My what now?
Your slat drops.
My slut drops?
Yeah, your movement.
What's a slut drop?
Come on, Darren. We're all looking at you puzzled, mate.
You've never done a slut drop before?
Oh, no. I have no idea what the fuck you're talking about.
So you like, and then you put your ass out.
So, really good for an audio medium, but for the listeners, what we've just witnessed is Darren moving his chair out of the way and then doing a squat, but then sticking his arse out towards the camera as he stands up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's done a squat with a arse push.
How did we get there? I know it was only about
movement.
10
minutes. It's a sexy movement, isn't it? Nice. I know. Oh, come on, Owen. I know you're high, but good grief.
I'm kidding.
So this is the movement episode. So we're going to talk all things movement. We're going to talk a bit about piling in and jamming and tagging and all that good stuff. So let's get right into it. Toby, I'll start with you.
Yeah.
Movement. Someone I know and speak to occasionally once said deployment is the first movement phase.
Mm.
So
I agree. Yeah.
I can't remember who said it. I think he's a bit mental. But even before that, I would say list writing is the pre-movement phase. You tend to play the similar style armies. Do you play kind of movement-based armies, or do you tend to kind of play different stuff just to start with?
Kind of. It depends what you mean with movement-based. I like to play out-of-sequence move armies, you could say. Okay. Yep. In general, armies with tricks up their sleeves. This can include movement.
Yeah, of course.
At the moment, I like Khorne a lot. Because everyone knows Murderlust, which everyone knows already. But also because you can also fight in a hero phase and have an extra move there. There's lots of things there. Or Siege, that's what I played before quite a lot. Where you can have some sneaky extra move with horror splitting and stuff like that. Denying opponent's move, which is also a big part of it.
Because it's harder for your opponent to visualize what's going to happen. The more tricks you've got up your sleeve, the harder it is for your opponent to visualize what could potentially happen. And therefore, they can make more mistakes, which you can capitalize on.
Yeah, I think this probably comes up later as well if we talk about it more in depth. But it's not just your movement. It's also disrupting your opponent's plans and, in this case, movement.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's not a lot.
And so do you find you're using those kind of techie lists mainly to disrupt your opponent, or do you find during your games you're using it kind of in your own sort of turns more?
I mean, it's a mix. So it does depend what you want. So you probably... So it depends. So especially if you play a singles list, then you will face lots of different opponents who will either, for example, they want to have a strong board presence. So you use your mobility to deny their board presence, to deny their mobility, just as turn one tagging, for example. Or you rather want to alpha strike yourself. So you want to do that, or you deploy in a way that they can't do this. So then this becomes often a mind game of what does your opponent know about your game plan or your army, and what do you know about his army? And then at some point, you try to deny the things your opponent want to deny you, and then it gets a bit complicated. But I think I like to write armies with outs is probably the best way to describe it, both in movement phase, but also in other phases. So even if my opponent attacks me turn one, I don't automatically lose the game.
Yeah, sure.
Stuff like that, yeah.
Yeah, perfect. And I guess, I mean, this came up in the Twitter question. It did, all this kind of jamming and locking and stuff came up as part of their question. So I guess we can go into it now, really. When you're locking people up, do you tend to use these? You mentioned Zinch. You mentioned, I've completely forgotten what the first army you mentioned was. Khorne. And I guess Soulblight can do this as well with the Legion of Night stuff. Do you tend to think about that as you're deploying? So you're seeing your opponent's army and you're thinking, right, I can block them off, I can jam them off right away? Or do you find you're doing it more reactively depending on what your opponent does?
So especially because I've played lots of teams, I usually plan that ahead before the game, actually. So, for example, when I do estimations, I can already plan ahead. Okay, so this guy, like, it's a slow fire slayer's army. Okay, I can take turn one. Move, for example, with Khorne, you can take turn one, move in there, and tag him at the end of his, at the start of his move, sorry, at the end of his hero phase. Mm-hmm. So he can't move, and maybe he doesn't have much output in the shooting phase, which in Fire Slayer's case is good. So he's even locked for the combat phase, so he can't even charge something behind it.
Yeah.
So stuff like that. You can plan that ahead. And then of course what you need to be very aware is the deployment. So it can be quite good for, if you have tricks up your sleeve, it can be fine if you're, for example, actually higher drops, as you can see, how your opponent is deploying and how you can counter deploy them either in a defensive way, or you play aggressive and punch them in. Of course, this tactic always kind of fails when your opponent has quite a bit of magic, quite a bit of shooting, and it's way harder. But it's not impossible either, depending on your army. I think you have to decide for the moment what is the best then in the situation. And I think it's you can plan ahead like 2-3 turns usually, but maybe 2-3, but latest, then it's basically a scramble and you need to decide on the fly what you do.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And you mentioned very quickly about the kind of drops in question. I think that's quite interesting, and I just want to get your take on it. So for something like Khorne or Soulblight, for argument's sake, you've got the higher drops, which enables you to kind of react to deploy in that way. You can pick your kind of avenues between terrain to jam people in. But on the flip side, they might go before you and therefore get out of that kind of bottleneck even before you've had a chance to do so. So how have you found with these kind of movement kind of techie lists, have you found it more useful to kind of see what they're doing, or have you found it more useful to kind of go first and then just pin them in from the get-go?
I mean, it depends on two things usually. So first of all, it depends a lot on the battle plan as well. There are battle plans where it's quite strong to pin in. And then there are battle plans like Pulse, where the game begins turn 2-3 basically, and turn one does not matter as much. So they have enough time to punch through. And our famous battle plan Nexus Collapse, which is always difficult anyway. And then it also depends a lot on how good my player is, actually.
Yeah,
because if I know it's a very good player, I know he won't fall for the easy trick. Okay, I move 16 inches and tag you turn one, and then your whole army can't move. Yeah. If it's a good player, he will be aware of it and have a screen there, and the unit behind it won't be within three, so I can't attack the screen, this unit behind as well. Maybe he puts in the front a unit that can retreat and charge, for example, as a screen. Or maybe he doesn't even have a screen, because depending on my army, I don't want to send something big in. So for example, if you have Khorne, you sometimes don't, you can tag with Blood Warriors, for example, which works well. But then again, there can be cases where you basically have just Bloodthirsters and you maybe don't want to throw them away in turn one. And there's maybe six Immortus Guard in the front. So it doesn't really matter if you tag them. So at this point, this plan doesn't really work, and you rather go for a traditional way. But you already know what he puts there, basically, at this point.
It can be a win-win situation for you as well, in so much as, so you want to go first. You want them to give you the first turn. But if they don't, they open themselves up to a Khorne double. Yep. So you're like, oh, great, I'll go first. I'll go second. Happy days.
Yeah, that's what I usually... So basically, when you write your army, when you deploy, you always go for both chances. So what I do is I give myself a very strong first turn. So that's the important one. But if I don't get it, I don't put my stuff that I'm fucked anyway. But rather, I then have an out, you could say, with a double turn. With Khorne, often, it depends how aggressive your list is, but often a double turn is a very, very good out because it can table your
opponent. So many options, absolutely.
Yeah.
Just going back to that planning question, Alex, as well. I think even before deployment, if you're playing the proper scenery rules, you can plan out how your avenues as attacks, where you put pieces of scenery down. You can create choke points and with like impassable terrain and garrisons and stuff like that.
Well, I wanted to ask a bit about this, Darren, because obviously there should be, you know, however many items of scenery on the board. And if you're playing these sorts of Khorne lists, I think it's fair to say most Khorne lists have quite a few units. I think that's probably fair to say for the
blood ties.
Yeah. And so it's that mixture between kind of board presence that we're talking about, you know, having all these pieces across the board, taking control of the board, enabling you to kind of move block and stuff. But versus that, if you're very confined into kind of a castle or whatever, well, you can use those bottlenecks more effectively. Do you think, I know it's hard to say in general because everything's so different, but do you think these lists with kind of these tricky movements, good movement, are better off in sort of castle-y type builds, or do you think they're sort of better off when you've got lots of different pieces, a bit chess-like, so you've got like more screens, more pawns, I guess, would be the comparison. Do you think it's better with lots and stuff, or actually do you think it's, or is it just too, everything's just so different you can't really generalize?
Yeah, I think it would depend on the person as well. So it's not just about the army, the pack, the scenery that's available, but it's also the type of person. Some people can't handle having too many options. They procrastinate. And then they run out of time, you know. So it's the optimal build on paper to have like loads of units, but it might not suit the person. So yeah, it's a difficult question to answer. I can answer it from my perspective.
Well, that I was going to say, because you've proclaimed yourself that you're kind of a more proactive player rather than a reactive.
Yeah.
So I guess then have you used ones like Soulblight, Khorne, and therefore You don't really use them reactively. You use it more as you influence your opponent rather than...
I used to use Khorne a lot when my brain was quicker. But as I've aged, I've realized that my brain isn't as quick anymore as it used to be. Yeah. So I find it too complicated for me to enjoy it. So in this year, you know, we were reflecting on our years earlier. Mm. Like the big thing that's happened this year for me is I've really reduced the model count. And I've really reduced the options, and it's made my plans. My macro planning has got a lot better, but my micro hasn't. So I think armies like Khorne, if you want to use them with lots of units, your micro has to be exceptional. And Toby is probably one of the best in the world at it, which is why
I have the time. Yeah,
you've got the time.
So I think.
And your macro is less important because the game develops. You can have like an overall plan, but as the game develops, if you've got more options, you've got more outs to work towards, and the skill for the Khorne player is knowing what's possible and keeping it all in your head. I can't do that anymore. I'm too fucking old. I've drunk too much alcohol.
Yeah.
In my youth, so like my brain shot to pieces. But I used to Runcorn, and I tried to make it as complicated as possible and absolutely loved it, but I can't do it anymore.
I think it's interesting to listen to your talk, because it's like taking Korn as an example, because they have some negatives to the book, like a first turn battle tactic and the grand strat tends to be a problem, but definitely in the context of movement and having units that can offer different roles, like things like flesh hounds and Furies,
yeah.
You know, you look at the Furies being put into lists quite a bit, and that is literally because of their movement stat, primarily. Mm-hmm. And being able to use those units in multiple ways, like it could just effectively be a turn one surround and destroy, which is an often seen play, or you might sacrifice the tactic and then leverage the fact that one unit can go a minimum of 15, and then you could perhaps auto six another one for 20, and then they're an immediately like an amazing board control pinning piece. So I think having, and then flesh hounds to a lesser degree, but I still think they're great for that. Like you were talking, Toby, about, you know, going into like a melee army and pinning turn one, often through an invocation, which is absolute misery hammer, but I love it. Yeah. You know, like that, not only do you have those fast units, which are quite cheap and throwaway, and then they feed into the blood tithe mechanic, but you've got things with killer instinct and murderlust. Like there are multiple allegiance abilities which add to that movement again.
Furies as well move out of sequence, don't they? Another thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, all of us have mentioned, because we're all like techie perverts, I think we've all mentioned like out of phase movement. So I was thinking about it before the start of the podcast about armies or units that have that ability. I think we can probably move on to talk about Flesh Eaters a lot, because they seem like a really excellent movement based army. Loads of, everyone seems to be bloody playing them at the moment as well. But I mean, things like, you know, Ungor. I really love playing with Ungor, with the rather than fight, then they sort of carry away the old skink rule. And like the Griffhounds moving after they've activated. Just going all sorts of places that you don't expect. So I think building in units that aren't necessarily like, oh, this is incredibly powerful or this is incredibly defensive. Often the techie units tend to be quite fragile, so they need to be played they need to be put in the list for a precise reason and then played very carefully. And then they're often traded out, but they, you know, they give you something very in the game which your opponent isn't expecting.
They're a problem that your opponent can forget. You know, you've thrown nine Minotaurs down their throat. They're not thinking about the Ungor in Dark Raiders that can teleport and then charge that character that's holding their home objective and then can just retreat away and just nick 2 points off them. They're not thinking about that. Or they are in turn one, but turn two was turn two was scary. Turn three, now it's turn five, their head's gone. They're forgetting these little techie plans. Yeah. And you've got them in your back pocket because you can't fucking wait to do it.
Definitely with the Ungor in, like, specifically to the army that I'm playing, like a movement trick that I love is the, you know, if you only create one combat, then they can be that retreat. So I nicked an objective off an opponent. He had three Ripodactyls on an objective. Yeah. And I could auto six run a unit to just one of them could touch it. And he was like, well, how are you going to take that off me if you can only get one? So I Darkwalkers four little Ungor that were left from a combat. And then they always get plus one to charge when they're set up, and they get plus one to charge on their war scroll. So it was a seven with a reroll. They charged in, activated them first, retreated out seven, and then nicked it off them that way. So
yeah,
I think those little plays, movement isn't just, like I was thinking about it earlier, movement isn't just a delivery mechanism for damage, is it? Like
I think there's lots of hidden movement as well. Like not just, we say out of sequence move from certain armies that just have them, like, okay, you can do a normal move in a hero phase. But there's also not necessarily out of sequence moves, but rather, hidden moves, like returning slain models is what FEC is now doing very well, right? So you get quite a bit of movement if just returning models, if the base is quite big, right? So there's quite a bit of movement that you can get there. And of course, also, breaking coherency is part of this as well. It's not necessarily that you get more movement, but it's rather that you
reduce your opponent.
You don't reduce his movement, but you can deny quite a bit, right?
And then you can add to what they need to get you.
Yeah, exactly. Like for example, over a double, and then also if you have stuff like clan rats or something, you can break currency at once at one place and bring them back somewhere else as well.
Yeah,
which is quite nice. So if one model is slain, you can still tag an objective somewhere else when you bring this model back or somewhere else.
Yeah.
At the phase.
I've done that before with I had 40 clan rats against in this big melee, and I gutted it and I split it so there was just one left. Yeah. And he was like, "What are you doing?" And then I killed the other 20 rats. So I had one guy left and he ran onto the objective, you know, because he's no longer in combat anymore. Yeah, so you can get out of combat doing that as well, can't you?
Yeah, famous Gwick's tactic, I think, if you are having the six handlers and then you attack with one handler or something, and then you roll all your six dice, you roll a one handler slain, and of course you remove the one that is tagged in combat. Suddenly your unit is free. Well, it's not necessary. This part is not necessarily movement, but it's rather denying the, because your opponent did something to deny you the movement. For example, he's blocking you with a sigil, which we have now in spawn corn, especially, right? So you get denied there, and then you can maybe still do some tricks there.
So I guess it's all about thinking about movement in terms of when stuff happens to other units, like they're dying or like you're splitting horrors or whatever.
Yeah.
It's worth realizing the movement potential you can get out of those sorts of...
I think it's always good that, especially if you have a goal, like I want this objective, then think of every little movement you can do, like pylons, charges, pylons, dying, bringing models back, every little bit that can help. And then with all of this, and think about all your special rules, and with all of this, there's actually quite a lot of tricks you can do to get the objective, like Owen said, with the retreat instead of activation. That was also a famous trick with Legion of the First Prince, where you would summon Furies, charge them in, and then of course it's a 9-inch charge, you charge them in, but then you retreat and have a 3-inch basically away from your opponent, so the only thing he can do is charge them. He doesn't have shooting. So
when you're considering all the little moves you can do, you should be also considering all the little moves and shenanigans your opponent can do.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of the times people make plans based on what they do, and then they haven't thought, "Oh, my opponent can pile in." Something as simple as that, you lose track of. Yeah. So when you're visualizing, make sure you pay as much attention to your opponent's models as you do your own.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess that's a good point to talk about the first movement phase, Darren, or the deployment phase rather, because I think lots of the messages that we got were people seem to get a bit stuck, and I can completely see why. They've kind of planned out their kind of out of movement phase list or list with none of these sorts of, you know, standard movement tricks. And they go to deploy and they think, right, I can go first and do all this stuff. But then they get worried that, hang on, I could get doubled here. And so don't want to move too far because then they might get doubled. But at the same time, they then don't move far enough, which then lets their opponent jam them, pin them in. What have you got any advice for people that are kind of having that like difficulty trying to figure out whether to go too far or not far enough, etc.?
You're thinking too much. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like it depends. So if you're a proactive player, like do your plan. You know, do your plan. Don't worry too much. And then if your plan doesn't work, then reflect on it later. But don't go into it and not do your plan.
Yeah,
don't do anything half-assed. If you go, if you want to go aggressive, go aggressive. If you want to just score, just touch the objective with one model on two objectives, score your battle tactic and call it a day and have more time for the later turns to think about it. Or if you want to stop your opponent from scoring, just go full ham and put everything on it. Like if you're a Soulblight player and you have lots of zombies, you're one drop, just take first turn, drop everything and see if your opponent can handle it. And then...
Think where, if you are just touching the objective, where's the optimal place to touch that objective? So something that Rob of the Honest Wargame has spoken about before is if he's taking an objective and he wants one unit, he will sometimes go as far away as possible rather than just walking onto it an inch because you're right next to it. Actually, I'm going to run to the far extreme because I know in two turns time,
my opponent's going to finally be able to charge onto that and take that objective on me. But that unit's now going to be as far away from the rest of the battle line as possible. So it's going to take it even longer to get back into the game. So, and that's relevant for movement. So if your objective is for this unit to take this objective this turn, where's the optimal place to keep it? But not for this turn, for next turn and the turn after. You could stand right at the edge of the objective, and it might mean your opponent misses a charge. Whereas if you just sloppily put, you know, just threw them in the middle, you've given them an easier charge.
Yeah.
So don't be lazy when you're making these. They feel like small decisions, but they can have massive impacts on the game. You know, two Tempesters taking an extra turn to be in range for their shooting. Fucking fantastic.
I
always like to be on the, it depends on the army, but often I also like that to be on the 3-inch circle. Just because even if my opponent doesn't even have deep strike or doesn't have any teleports, it's still good because it always means you can redeploy.
Yes.
Because as soon as he touches, because you're a 9, so you can
also. That's a nice basic principle as well that you're going to be able to remember throughout the game. I like that. It's like an anchor, isn't it? A core principle.
Yeah, if you're like 2 millimeters off the circle, then why not just go on anyway? Because otherwise your opponent can stop a redeploy, right?
One thing I like doing as well is, like, for example, say a unit of 10 Ungor. I use them all the time for capping early game. And you're right. You could just touch one. And then I like to have, if I want to make my opponent come out as far as they want, because I always like to tease a castle apart. You know, I like to pull a castle out wide and then pick it apart with the beast's army. So I might run on or I might touch on, and then I'll always have a diagonal line running away from my opponent's army, and I'll have my hero and my banner and I'll have my command models right at the back. So if I am taking models, they'll always be away and then going back to the point where I'm going to keep, you know, my three lads to rally back on fives or whatever. So that's one, you know, you just touch. Or if my opponent's got 5 Boingrot Bounders or 5 Drakespawn Knights or 3 Pterodactyls, I will always put 6 models, or I'll put 4 models. I'll always outpoint the unit that they can move out onto the flank with, so that they then have to overcommit something else, or, you know.
Or risk fucking up.
Or just give me that flank and just, all right, damn it, I won't go for 1-2 more. I'll just concentrate in the center and keep my shape, or they move out of shape. So I think that one simple movement of moving 10 lads on, or I'll just put as many as I want on and move to the 3-inch line as Toby described, which I really like the idea that it always gives you a redeploy. I hadn't actually considered that, but normally it would be, I don't want them to just hop on with a teleporting unit or something. Yeah. But yeah, even just if, as you say, if you go, right, I'm not going to go big early. I'm going to just take my 5 points, get my 1-2 more, keep my castle in place, keep my screens in place, move my character up. Again, I think movement, you guys will have opinions on this, but where, what you commit and where you place a single wizard to stop magic dominance turn one, I think that is actually something that you should always really consider. Like, I've changed my beast list to have a very fast wizard that will have some impact later in the game. But
so you can look him right at the back.
Yeah, exactly. So generally I'll be like, okay, I'm either going to make them think I'm going to give them first by saying my wizard's within 30 of all your lads, or I'll consciously put him out because I don't really have another tactic that I want to do turn one. So I'll definitely be outside of 30 with this guy. And then having a model that is then fast enough to then have some impact in the rest of the game.
I think I agree with this. I think in Beast, because you just have a Bray Shaman and the general who's off the board, I expect.
Yeah. So,
but otherwise, I actually think you should, if it's a different army, just always put your wizards out. It's a bit of a trick against probably not too good players, but still, always put your wizards out. Say they're outside 30, but put one hero in range who's not a wizard, in 30 of all their wizards. And then when they ask you, are you out of 30 with your wizards, you say yes. But I can still unbind. So you have basically the best of both worlds.
Cool. Or you play Legion of Night and do the trick where you heroic move them.
You just teleport everywhere anyway. Yeah, exactly.
That's even better.
Just to pick up on one of those points there, because it adds a bit of strength to what I was saying. The choice is where you put your command in the unit. So this is future planning. This is so important. Visualize the board. What's going to happen if I lose seven models? Well, I've got to keep the command in the center. So that's important. Every decision is important. It doesn't look important, but every decision is important. And also, look where your opponent's putting their champions and their command. Because if they're one of those buggers that just takes it off and goes, oh, yeah, that's my champion. No, he's not. Your champion's dead. Mm-hmm. You know, so if they're putting their command, the next time you're playing a Beast of Chaos player and they're putting their command in the middle, you know they're not thinking on the same level that Owen Jackson is. Brilliant. Take advantage of that. No, but that's right. If that would be a really clear signal to me that this person isn't considering the very minute details, that's going to embolden me. Whereas if I see someone pulling an Owen Jackson, I'm going to be like, I'm going to need to concentrate more. But
Alex. Sorry, Darren. You don't get to play as much as you'd like. I think, Alex, that would be true to say. But whenever you do play, I know that you like playing very fast, impactful armies. You know, like I've played against you with eels, which again are one of the fastest. And, you know, at the moment, we've got these movement based armies like, you know, all the sharks. I know that they're a bit obnoxious to play against, but it's not just the fact that they've got exploding sixes on all of their attacks. It's they do have the ultimate, they're like the ultimate delivery mechanism army at the moment, aren't they? You just put it on the table and it's going to be able to inflict damage on their opponent from the get-go. So what do you like about the really fast armies, and what is that just a play style for you, or you know, because obviously they tend to, the faster the army, the more fragile it is. So is it the fact that you can dictate the tempo that you like having playing fast armies over
a
more?
It's exactly that. Well, we talked about this slightly before, but I guess I'm similar to Darren in that I'm not a world champion, obviously, but I am a very
proactive. My heart.
But I am I know I'm proactive rather than reactive. So I know I'm not a very good reactive player, but I do like being able to, if I see a mistake in deployment or if I see something happen, I like having the ability to kind of have reach. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy being able to punish mistakes. And I know personally, I find it really frustrating if I'm using something and I see a mistake that I then can't do anything about. It makes me really frustrated. It makes me physically, I can't do anything. Yeah. I've seen this thing, but I don't have the ability to move far enough or go far enough to take advantage of that mistake. And so I know that just pisses me off it just annoys me viscerally that I can't take advantage of that. So I make sure that I'm using something that I can take advantage of. You know, if something's in the corner in the wrong place or something's far away, or if they don't do any mistakes, then I can go and kind of do my plan, kind of what Toby Darren was saying. I like being able to do my thing, and that's what I quite enjoy. That's
why I relate to that because I never actually played the Khorne lists with like lots of Blood Warriors because I'm not that much of a mortal fan. I've always been a demon fan, but nowadays I play actually quite aggressive Khorne armies with, for example, the in Luxembourg. I went with three Boomthirsters.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes,
and Skarbrand.
What was your best boom moment?
My best boom moment. I mean, there were some. I think the best thing is always when you get two booms out of one Thirster.
Yeah.
And you just win. I think against, I don't think it was in this game, but against another big WoW game, I just had the double boom and there was four heroes dead and I was in base contact in 3 inches with with Argus, with the Vurgok Prophet, and he was also dead.
Fuck you.
Nice.
The fight again with my boom Thirster.
Yeah, exactly. So that's always nice. This is basically an army that comes down again to what you say. You can capitalize on your opponent's mistake. As soon as you see something, you can 24 inch move there or even more with some blood tithe, with Murderlust, and then charge in there. And then as soon as there's, of course, a gap for the base size, that is of course a thing, then you can just kill the thing. Or, I like putting Valkyrie in. So, small heroes who are fast with small base sizes are also very good for capitalizing on mistakes. In the past, it was so last edition, for example, the from Nighthaunt, the little, what was his name again?
Yeah.
Yeah, the little guy with
roundhouse
kicks everyone, depending on how many models are close. That was a prime example for this. As soon as there's a little gap in the that you can charge over, sometimes even, or with eels, for example, sometimes the opponent doesn't screen he's not aware that you can charge over the screen and have a place to place your models, right? And then suddenly you get in and can punish them really hard. And that's where these heroes are great. And the Boomthirsters then are also good. If, of course, the 8 inches is great. And then I think what I like to have is, that's where what Owen said with Flesh Hounds, what I like to do with them is I can capitalize on these mistakes without actually throwing away my Thirster. Because what I do is I charge in my Thirster on a unit, and then I charge in the Flesh Hounds, but around the back of the unit. So this means that in the next turn, the Thirster kills the thing, the Flesh Hounds pile in, and then with the pile in, create another screen for my Thirster again. Mm. And then ideally, pile in a way that it depends what your opponent feels, but if your opponent doesn't have 3-inch weapons, for example, you can pile in a way that you are 2.4 inches in front of your Thirster with every part of the Flesh Hound base. So this means whenever he charges you, you can first roar him or stomp him, and then you can fight whereas he can't reach you. And you do all of this after you already killed one of his units. Mm. So you will always uptrade, and even more uptrade because you got a Blood Tithe. Mm. But you still need to be, of course, you need to engineer these situations. But if you can capitalize on his mistakes, then do this, and then you basically uptrade it by a lot, right? You didn't lose anything. Except for maybe from positioning wise, you would also be a bit out of place, but because your stuff is fast enough, it's okay.
This is an example though of like I say, future planning. This is something you could have thought about before any game, and it's a play that you can have in your pocket. And then throughout the game, as it develops, you're looking for situations where you can use these plays. Good players will be thinking about these plays that they can do with their army. So when you create a new army, so it's not just specific to Khorne, this situation that Toby's describing there, because all armies have got various plays that they can make that will be like this. So find them all and then have them in your back pocket, and throughout the games be looking for situations you can do it.
I can give you another one for Beast, which is very similar, and it goes to we could probably have a conversation about using, you know, you talk about how deployment is the first movement phase. Well, the charge phase is another free movement phase, and it's super impactful. And I don't think I see as many players doing it as I used to. Like, to name check him, I learned so much from playing against Benjamin Sava, when he was charging with the no retreat bone grins, bone splitters, locking up whole armies and using the charges to just corner tag things. But I mean, a play that I will often do is I have two units of 6 Bulgor who obviously want to blow stuff up. Yeah. And anyone who knows how to play against beasts knows that you just basically, they have to drop at the end of turn 2 or in turn 2. And then fundamentally, it's just I want to make you trade your bulls for something that I don't care about losing. So a way that I've found that I can get around that to a degree is that I will always power pair up 6 bulls with 10 Ungor. And the 6 bulls will generally detonate whatever they want to charge into. But if you make that 7-inch charge with the Ungor, then, you know, multi-charging units, so that Toby reminded me of this about Flesh Hounds, using one unit as the actual killing unit and then the other unit as the protective unit. Yep. So the bulls will go in, they'll charge, they'll blow it up. Then the Ungor, I've charged them in such a way that I know then that I can get a 3-inch pile round. So that starts to screen the front of that. If I'm, you know, if you know that you're either not going to get the turn or you have the chance of losing the prio, I'll pile round my Ungor a little bit to start screening off the unit. And then if anything gets close to that unit,
redeploy it.
Then you just redeploy the screen further round again. Mm-hmm. So using the charges, and again, charging a unit to get onto an objective that your opponent wasn't expecting, using a charge not to just crash into the front lines of your opponent's unit, but to touch the corner and then go somewhere crazy that they weren't expecting and zone out some of the board.
I've got an example. I've got an example of this. My friend Tony, I was playing, And he was like, oh, if you see anything that I'm doing really daft, point it out. But otherwise, we'll have a proper game. And this is going back a long time ago. This is Duality of Death. And I was playing Seraphon. So Crocon won on the vortex that you couldn't touch. The rest of my army around it. And then just a Shaman on the other one, Duality of Death. And the point being, you go get 2 points and then you spend the rest of the game. Your opponent can only get one because Croak's on the other one. So very simple plan, my favorite. And he charged 10 Boingrots onto this Shaman in his turn and he surrounded it. And I was like, right, Tony, here's a teachable moment. Like, how many of those Boingrots do you think it's going to take to kill that Shaman with 4 wounds and an armor save of 6? And he's like, oh, 1 or 2. I was like, right, so put 4 just in case and then string the 6 out because you've rolled a 10 towards the rest of my army so that if you win the priority, you're going to be 6-7 inches closer to my battle line. And those Boingrots are going to be able to take part in the next turn. Whereas if you do what you've done, you're not going to get there for 2 turns. So it's future planning. You know, just when you're moving your charges, assess each situation. Imagine where is it going to, you know, at the end of this combat, what's going to happen? If you've got 2 units in, like that situation you described there, Owen, what's going to happen when this unit destroys that unit and this unit's now free to move again unimpeded? You know, do I want to be that closer? Do I want to try and shimmy around, etc.? But you've always got to be living in the future. And this is the skill, I think, that separates the good from the great, you know. And if you're not doing this at the moment, at any point within a game, stop and try to imagine the board in 5 minutes' time. And then try to imagine the board in 10 minutes' time. 20 minutes time, and you'll get better and better at it, but do that with movement. So fucking important. Do it with deployment, but do it with movement.
Yeah, and I think what's important there is just sometimes people, so it depends what kind of person you are, but often if people sometimes tell me, well, I don't know where I end up, or I'm not sure if I can get enough on, or something like this. It's actually just math it out. Like, if you get this charge, like, you're this far away, right? You can do this from the deployment. If you move this far, you can run and charge. You run 6. You get an average of 7-inch charge. You get +1 on your charge rolls. You have an 8-inch charge. You then pile in 3 and so on. And so you can, and then you have a base size of, I don't know, 1. Let's just say you are small base. And this means you have 1-inch base size, around 1-inch, +1-inch space in between, a bit less. And then you just multiply this by your models, keep coherency at some places, so subtract a bit, and suddenly you can actually math quite a bit out of how far you can get. With horrors back when they were more played with, for example, with a 30 block, you would often do this. You would charge in. Of course, you math it out anyway because you have Destiny Dice. Of course, you need to math it out. So you always calculate beforehand how. Okay, I need Destiny Dice. I need an 11. No problem. I take the 11. And then with that, I string them in a way that I control all the objectives. Of course, I don't gain control of them, but I can always deny my opponent when he gets on. And then you charge in, touch with one model, and then I fight. I do nothing or almost nothing. My opponent fights, and I take away the first models or split them farther back. So next turn, he can fight with less. But he's still within 3 inches to still tag him. You can do lots of stuff there. And you can also math this out where, okay, when I split, because with the horror splitting, it follows rules where you can put them. So you can math everything out. And then with this, you can plan quite a bit ahead. And if you, so there's always prep you can do, I would say, for these situations.
Toby, with that, do you plan out, so of lots of the comments that be made, which is obviously should be super helpful for the listeners, is a lot around visualizing and planning out what you can do so that when you come to your movement phase, you know what to do. Do you go as far as splitting it up even more than that? So, and what I mean by that is, let's say you have your horrors and you know you have a, I don't know, for argument's sake, let's just say a 7-inch charge to make it in, but really you need I don't know, a 9 or something to really get as far as you want to. Do you plan it out to the point where if you roll under what you want, so let's say you roll the 7, so you've made it in, but it's not quite far enough to do what you want. Do you make a plan for that scenario and think, well, okay, if I roll a 9, great, I can do the things I want to. But if I roll a 7, okay, that's not what I quite wanted, but I've still got the plan ready to go for that scenario. Does that make sense? Do you plan that?
You have plan A, which is, of course, rolled a good charge. I think Scene just maybe a bad example, but let's say you don't have the Destiny dice. You don't have guys ready. You need them for your grand strategy. So you can't do a 9-inch charge, which happens. Then, yes, you first have a plan A. Before you even start moving, especially if there's a terrain piece, you measure out where you can get. And then you also take into account, then I can pile in. Then I can split. Do I now, with all of this, can I get where I want to be? If the answer is no, but it's like game winning, then you like do everything to get plan A going. If you are like, okay, if it doesn't work, I'll just go with plan B. It's okay. It could be worse. Then you go with plan B. And then usually I have like two plans if it works or if it doesn't work. I think three plans is a bit too much. It would be too much as well. But it's good to have a second plan, I would think.
I ask it just because I've seen lots of people, I'm sure I've done this myself, where you need your big hammer unit or whatever to get as far enough to get in, but you roll enough to make a charge or you do enough just to get in, but actually it's probably not quite enough to do what you want them to do. But you've kind of set your mind to it and you've gone, well, hang on, I'm going to do this thing, and therefore you still do it, but you don't get enough of the models in to actually do what you wanted to do, et cetera, et cetera.
I think it's difficult to say, but in general, if it's game winning and like you need the luck, like, okay, you need to kill this. This is the battle tactic. This is the last turn. You need to kill this to win the game. And of course you do it because you can always roll well, maybe with just two models that can get in contact. But if it's like turn two, you roll the charge, you know you won't kill your opponent's units, your opponent can then bring them back, I don't know, maybe it's Squicks or something, right? Then he brings them back and you're like, well, you gain nothing at this point, right? You rather don't charge in this case and have a second plan like, okay, I don't charge, because then at least your opponent has to do something to kill you.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you just give it for free.
At least
your opponent has to go for you. You should always do your plans, but if you can do them confidently, but in this case the plan maybe isn't the best if it relies on a big charge. And if that doesn't go off, you're in a bad place. It's not good.
At least if it doesn't go right, make your opponent work for it rather than just giving it to them in the first place.
It's good to have second plans in general because of this, like an alternative. For example, what's quite good is if your hammer is a flying unit, then you have a screen, then just in case, always move the screen in front of the flying unit. It doesn't really matter if it's to the side, like that's not its job anyway. So just move it in front, just in case. And also be aware that if you don't charge, you can always redeploy because you're not in combat. So you always have a little out, right? Because your opponent comes to you, you can redeploy away at least.
Yeah.
If you charge in and you don't do enough, then you can't redeploy because you're locked in combat. So.
If you are the opponent, be wary of that 9 inches when you're moving to try and deny that. if you think he's going to pull out a 6 for his redeploy, then don't move within 9.
That's
the sort of thing that people forget.
Darren, there were a few questions about jamming and kind of board presence and move blocking and all that sort of thing. Do you tend to... Let me rephrase. Let me put this a different way. When you're writing lists and thinking of jamming and move blocking, do you tend to write or use army lists with the ideal to block and jam movements, or do you tend to just do that with lists even if you haven't specifically thought about it? So I guess what I'm asking is, do you set out to use army lists specifically to jam, block, pin stuff, and therefore do you use specific units to do that, or will you just be doing this in general in kind of every game?
I think it's a meta relevant problem, in so much as if you know there's lots of Soulglite and they've got 60 zombies, then I absolutely want a unit that's capable of going into them and stopping them moving and everything that's behind them. But if there's not a great deal of zombies, there's loads of stonehorns, then that unit potentially is wasted. So yes and no.
It will be
what my ultimate tournament strategy is. What am I facing in rounds 4 and 5? Because I'm going to get into a winning position. They're going to be my toughest games, and then I'll try to gear my army around that. And then depending on what army lists I think I'm going to be fighting in rounds 4 and 5 will depend on how much jamming I think potentially I need.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I think you absolutely can, but it's not the be-all and end-all.
Okay.
It depends how good of a player you are. If you're a very good player, you can go with a one-trick pony, like, okay, this is my pinning army, and this does pinning, right?
Yeah.
You can go with that and can go 4-1 or something with it. Mm. If you're, let's say, a mid-table player usually, so you go 3-2 often, it's quite risky to play this because you might not face these armies, and then you will... Mm. Because this is your game plan, right? And you only have this game plan in mind, and you maybe have problems adapting very, very fast to this, or you basically can't win by having a better skill than your opponent, because your opponent does mistakes and you do not. Then it's a bit risky to just play this one game plan. I pin him, and then you have an army that cannot be pinned, and you just lose. So that is a bit bad. I think putting in 1-2 units. If you are singles, I think putting in 1-2 units with either movement shenanigans or good pinning pieces, like in the tree lord, right, for order, right? Put a tree lord in to stop the pylon, and then also and stuff like that is like very nice. Strike last, yeah. So that is very nice.
You've almost read my notes, Toby. I was just about to ask. I was just about to ask what all three of your favorite units for kind of jamming, pinning, movement. Well,
that's not mine, because it's order, and I'm a chaos guy.
Oh well, there we go. Well, what's your favorite then, Toby? If you had to pick one, you're only allowed one unit. Putting you on the pinning? Spot now.
Yeah. Okay, I'm gonna do an out pick that is good against the new cities now, which everyone wants, and that is probably almost never played, and that is in Khorne, Karanak, and then you summon the flesh out to combat. They also cannot shoot back, for example. Because of the commands, there's also no counter charges. So I'm gonna pick Karanak, which is probably quite an off pick for some people.
Mm, yeah, fair enough. And again, you've kind of visualized, you have the plan for it already before you've even got to the table, before you even put anything down.
Yeah. I think especially if you play, because I mostly play teams nowadays. And then I think it's when you build the army, you also build it for specific counters, right? You have them in mind. Okay, against this, I can definitely counter, so this will be a good matchup for me. And against all the others, I have some bad ones, but against all the others, I'm still fine. But you definitely have some matchups where you build into.
Yeah, fair enough. That makes sense. A bit like what Darren was talking about, you're kind of planning for the, I guess for you, for teams, but for Darren, that round 4 or 5, whether you need it or not. Darren, favorite sort of movement-based pinning, jamming, board presence unit? Do you have one?
Movement-based pinning, jamming.
I've got one.
All right, Owen, do you want to go and then give Darren a bit of a chance to have a think?
Sure.
I would just go back. Okay, I'll give you mine and then I'll give you an opinion on something. Just because it's Misery Hammer, and also I think it's wonderful in the right hands and as babies in teams, but Glockin and Sloppity Bile Piper together are just like, oh my God, like that combo will just win games, just,
and it does.
yeah
why we see so many of them.
Just like pop a little Sloppity up and then counter charge in your plague bearers and, you know, just stop pile-ins, and yeah, it can be, you know, you can just set your castle up and just completely win the game based on that one bit of movement shenanigans. I've never played with it, but having witnessed it, I watched Max at Six Nations play a couple of times, and I really liked watching that. It looked horrendous.
Yeah, But I played it in a team tournament with the old Bellicor, Kairos, whatever it was called, Legion of the First Prince, that one, with Sloppity, Bellicor, Kairos, and just can't move.
Yeah,
just constant, just standing still. It's so annoying. But yeah,
I can see Toby smiling.
That was so annoying. So annoying.
Annoying is good. Yeah, I do have to say the other pick I need to shout out. Unfortunately, kind of. Well, not unfortunately, but just the sigil from Zinch, because it's probably my favorite.
Oh, yeah. Well,
ever, and it's won me. I don't know. It's probably won me like half most of my games just by having it.
Yeah, you beat me at Worlds because of that stupid thing.
Yeah, and because
Cockatrice of the tagging, Toby. Just because of the tagging.
Yeah, mostly the tagging. But I think people are a lot of people are unaware that it's actually a very good tagging piece, even if your opponent has lots of wounds, because you just put your own models in. So, and you create a spawn from your own models, basically.
Yeah, I was about to say, for listeners who don't know what the sigil is, just quickly explain what it does so they know what we're talking about.
So basically, it's a Zinj Endless spell that you can, if you're Zinj or have the new Army of Renown, Regiment of Renown, then you can set it up pre-game so it cannot be unbound. And then at the end of the movement phase of any player, you roll a dice for each enemy unit within 9 inches of the sigil. For each unit within 9 inches of the sigil. And on a 4+, the unit takes D3 mortal wounds. You roll for all the units. After you've rolled for everyone, you can see where models were slain. And then you can set up a chaos spawn within 3 inches of a unit where a model was slain. So this means you slay, for example, one of your own Kyric Acolytes, and then you can set up a spawn within 3 inches of, for example, the other end of the Kyric Acolytes where your opponent wants to charge you. And because the base size of the spawn is quite, well, it's not that big, but 2 inches. So this means you can lock your opponent within 3 inches. So, for example, as soon as your opponent is within 8 inches, usually, that's the rule of thumb, you can always stop him charging. This also means that your opponent needs to be more than 9 inches away, basically, for charges, because otherwise you redeploy as well, right? Yeah. So basically, you can force him to always have 9-inch charges or leave it up to luck that you don't roll a 4+.
Yeah, of course.
So that's very strong, of course.
And when you do this, because this was another question we had sent in, when you're pinning and tagging people in this way, do you tend to pin units in right front and center so that they have to then get around you if they're retreating and out of three? Or do you tend to pin tag units on the side or behind so that then they have to move in a different direction, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it depends what you want to do, where you want them to go. If you don't want them to pile onto an objective that you want to take later, you don't go there, of course, because otherwise they pile on. If you want to, if you create a spawn in your opponent's, from your opponent's army, you of course don't want to put the spawn close to, in the direction that he wants to pile anyway, so he doesn't pile into your models. So you put it on the other side. Usually the rule of thumb is make sure that not many models can attack the spawn, or that he needs to move out of range. So, for example, for back then when Kairos could create a spawn, you would often tag your opponent at the backside of the at the back basically. Mm-hmm. So if he wants to kill them, at least he needs to give up some of his movement, like 3 inches to go to the back, right, or stretch his arm, his unit out. So he loses a bit of movement there. But I think if you plan, for example, a multi-charge in general, that's good, not just with sigil. If you plan a charge with one of your like, let's say, glass hammer units, right? But one is not enough. You need two, or you need two combats at two different places. And you always then what you do is what you explained. You basically charge, and I charge in my Thirster on point A against the unit, and on the other unit the other Thirster. So one of them will get hit, basically, right? So you charge your screen in and make sure that the screen takes the full front of the damage as much as possible. That works especially well if your opponent has 1-inch reach. Yeah. So you charge in a way that basically that he can't he can maybe hit you with two or three models.
Yeah,
right? And he just kills the screen, which you like as Khorne anyway. You do murder rolls, you get a blood tithe, and then you can hit him back. So and if you have this, or if it comes to, so I had a game two tournaments ago where there was a big squig hurt, and I charge. So they usually string for the fight on death guy. They string quite far, and I actually charged where the string was kind of like, so where the one models were keeping to currency. That's where I charged Scarbrand in, and then on the front of the unit, where the lots of squigs are, I knew that he wanted to pile in closer to Scarbrand with all of them, because they also fight on death. So
yeah.
There's quite a bit of movement there. And also they run away, but only to units. They need to be quite close to the units that they've for the mortal wounds. So then I put all my heroes around the squigs in a circle in the front, out of 4 inches, of course, so he can't hit them. So he can pile into them, but he's locked then. So he doesn't want to do that anyway, but he also can't pile backwards to Scarbrand in this case.
Yep.
And so you can then kind of lock him where he wants to pile.
Yeah.
Because he can't spread out because you're all around him, right?
Yeah, so fair enough.
There's lots of stuff there.
Yeah, that's good. Darren.
Severith is my...
I was going to say that for you. I was going to say, hang on, how have you not said Severith? Yeah, hey, that's my favorite as well. Yeah, go on, Darren.
I've been playing with him a great deal. I noticed in early 2023 that there wasn't a great deal of shooting, and it meant that people were taking bigger and bigger units like the Gotkin, like Teclis. They were back in the meta because they couldn't be killed straight away. So I wanted to take shoot cast and take 9 long strikes so that I could kill your big thing before you moved it. Fuck you. However, Stormcast aren't so good at battle tactics. And this was, I was using this list before they got their recent update. So one way to solve that is Severith, because of all the beautiful movement. He's helpful for surround and destroy. He's helpful for lead into the maelstrom. He's helpful for intimidate. And he's also, because when he charges, he's got movement 24 for a start. Beautiful. Then he moves another 12. So you can basically pin any unit you want that's on the board if you deploy him in the middle. Now, obviously, put him in a one drop to make sure that reach is insane. Quick little side note, if you're playing against a Severith and you don't want your characters to die, don't put them within 9 inches of the front line, because he will just wang up there and he will shoot you.
Yeah.
I've killed so many vampire lords because I'm waiting to see if they're within 9 inches of the front line, and they always do it. Brilliant.
Yeah.
He's fucking dead. Fuck you, Blizzard. Dead.
Just to explain that, Darren, for people that don't know what you're talking about.
You can't look out, sir, if you're within 12 inches. So he's got movement 24. So first of all, Severus was in 36 inches. Yep. I'm able to get within 12 inches. If you've got him within the 9 inches of the front line, then I can get within 12. So then I can shoot you. And Severus hits on twos. Wounds on threes, rend 3, damage d3. And I will sometimes prioritize killing that vampire lord with Blizzard than I might do the target that I'm going to shoot my 9 long strikes at. So I might give Severus +1 to hit, so he's hitting on twos. I might have best aid ever him, or my list is 1950, so chances are I've got inspired. So I've got two ways of getting a profile that's twos, rend 3, damage d3. So on average, it's 6 to 8 wounds to a vampire lord, for example. And most people aren't saving their all-out defense for that, because I've shot 9 long strikes at the dragon, you know, and they're all-out defensing that. I love that. Bait and switch. Beautiful.
Yeah.
But from a pinning perspective, a couple of reasons why he's so good. So firstly, he can get to anywhere. Secondly, when he charges, he can pile in 6 inches and he doesn't have to go towards the enemy. So you can hit one unit and then end up elsewhere. Okay, and he's got a reach of 3 inches on both his weapons, so both of those are going to be able to do damage to whatever you're trying to pin. And also, when he charges on a 3+, he does a mortal wound, and you're then -1 to hit, so it mitigates the damage that's coming back to you.
Yeah.
A nice little trick, I think. Severith is really nice in IDNF because you can shoot them or any army, or perhaps any army that can have Severith and a Sharkin. Because you can shoot that unit, make it not be able to pile in, and then charge Severith in it, and then dodge him away. And then they can't touch him. Fantastic. Yeah. So he's safe for a turn. So it's really good over the double, because if you hit the priority, you can then piss off. He's got a special rule that allows him to retreat and still charge, so he can do it again.
And obviously,
he moves 24. Anything he goes over on a 3+, they take D3 mortal wounds. And when he moves again with the 12 inches on the 3+, he does D3 mortal wounds. So you're still able to cause damage, even though you've retreated. And then you can charge and do it again. Marvelous.
Glorious. Yeah, he's fucking fantastic. So he's really good in Stormcast because he helps you with all the battle tactics, and then he's a way of slowing them down. And if you've got a shooting army, you want to slow your opponent down. The whole time they're dealing with Severith, they're not dealing with your nine long strikes, which are doing the real damage. He's also really tanky. Like, he's got 10 wounds. He's only got a 5-up armor save, but he's got a 5-up ward save. And sometimes you spike. Wonderful. 7/5 pluses from 10 dice. You feel fucking great. Sometimes it happens. And when he dies, you do feel bad, but they've spent so long dealing with him that you've still got, you look down and you've still got 9 long strikes. You're happy.
Yeah, I
think it's really good. I think people do this thing where if a unit gets nerfed, they automatically think, oh, it's no good anymore, because they're comparing it to how it was. But that was, you know, so I don't think people were looking at foxes for a very long time, since it changed from it moving in every shooting phase to just your shooting phase. It's still fucking brilliant. There's so many options against, if you've got some terrain that's bigger than Severith and you're fighting shooting armies, you can fly over it, shoot, and then move back, and then you can't be shot.
Great. And if it's in Lumineth, it gets to go 60 inches. So
if you go,
gets to go to the next table along and fight them as well.
Yeah,
exactly. I think it's a lot also depending on the meta, right? Because other armies now got nerfed as well. Armies that hasn't been nerfed for quite a while are popping off again. And then, I mean, that's what we are often doing as coaches, is basically you already know the net lists, right? That's not what people need. They don't need the net lists, and you're giving them net lists. You need to give them, so you need to be aware of the meta, first of all, and then you want to have counter pieces. And it's what Darren was saying, Sarah is awesome against everything that needs small heroes, like Fek, for example, right? That's just coming out. So sniping these heroes is great. And then same as against movement, against armies that have slow movement or that don't have shooting or that don't have mortal wounds in the hero phase, you can tag them in. So having these units to counter the meta, you don't have to have a whole army to counter the meta. You can still play your Stormcast. You can still play your, your Sylvaneth or something, and then you put one unit in to counter the meta. And we're talking about movement. This is now not movement only. But it's the same thing. You put one unit in to control this, and suddenly you open quite a lot of options for plays, right?
Yeah, makes sense.
And again, the more plays you've got, the more your opponent cannot notice it, may not notice it.
Yeah,
like with Severith as well, he's got all this movement, 36 inches, and then he charges and he flies, and then he piles in 6, and he's got a reach of 3. So, like, he can get to a character that was behind an army that was 36 inches away, or even more than that, 36, 48, 54, 57 inches potentially.
Yeah.
So that's a really hard thing to actually visualize when you're moving your models about. And again, you can be really conscious of that 9 inches thing, and then you get distracted. Someone buys you a beer or something, or someone asks you a rule question, and then you do your movement phase, and then all of a sudden your character's in within 9 inches of the front row.
Also, go back to movement as well. It may just be that because you're so damn fast, to win the game against a load of rampaging Stonehorns, like on turn 4 or 5, you just fly them in between two bits of impassable, and then Bosh, there we go.
Which you could have planned for, not before even before deployment, when you were putting the scenery down. Right, in turn 4, I think the game's going to be here. I'm going to have two pieces of, you know, you can be creating those situations. Yeah, absolutely.
What I liked when you mentioned the shark with the no pylon is also an oversaturation of these things will just make your opponent not just forget about them, but also even if he is aware of all of it, it does force him to do a bad decision in any way. So I always like to play I give my opponent, I actually don't deny all the options to my opponent. I rather give my opponent options, but whatever he does has a bad taste to it. So he can do it, but it's always bad. There's no good decision.
Yeah, it was the optimal play and it still pisses them off.
Exactly. So that's your optimal play. And we both know that's the optimal play, But yeah. I can, so for example, it was quite a while ago, but in Prague back then, I played against Geir Vedelt, I think, in the singles, mm-hmm. and he was playing with Pigs, and I was playing Zinch, and it was on this battle plan where I would have just got pushed in, and I would just win lose by this. So what I did was I put all my monsters, so Kairos, I was back with Legion of the First Prince, Kairos, the Demon Prince, and Bellacor within 2.4 inches of my front line of Horus, because I knew he would power charge me in. And so the trade-off was he was still doing it because it was the correct play, but at least I could fight with all my heroes every combat phase, because that's what he does. He pins me in with waves, but this means I fight every combat phase with all my heroes where they don't get damaged, right? So yeah, basically giving your opponent options is sometimes fine if all of them are bad options.
Yeah, sure.
You won that game, right, Toby?
I didn't win, unfortunately. I lost by one point against him, because it was what would nowadays be Fountains, and I basically had the castle with 20 horrors, so I'm on two objectives basically against all Diamond Jaws while he's on four, and he had lower drops. So so it was hard to win anyway.
And but you gave yourself an out. You played to win, didn't
you? Yeah. I mean, there's always a few. Yeah, if I won, I can't actually remember if it came down to priors, because it was quite a while ago. But often if it's that close and you get one important prior, you can still win, right?
Great. I think we've answered pretty much every question. There is one question remaining that we got sent, and Owen, I'm going to throw it over to you, buddy.
Oh, Lord. Okay.
The question was, cloud or line? That was the question. And I know what they mean. I think what they're trying to ask is it better to move units that you have? And I guess they're referring to kind of board presence and jamming, etc. Does it tend to be better to move units in just a straight line, because people just do that by default? I think humans like lines. Or is it actually worth thinking about, hang on, could I do this in a U shape, a circle shape?
I'm going to subvert your question and say that all shapes are possible and all have wonderful reasons behind why you should do it. I think talking about the pinning and the tagging earlier, like the upside down T is probably my favorite for the charge, if you're just literally looking to pin them in place. Because as Toby described, like if you do an upside down T and just touch at half an inch, you know, with either a durable unit or whatever kind of unit you want, then when your opponent hits you back, then you're taking from the bottom of the T, if you know what I mean. And you always take your casualties to then sit at 2.9, so they're still tagged, and then you start to then take from the edge. So amend your shape based on what you want to do. You know?
Use shapes liberally.
Yes. Like a straight line that then bridges two pieces of terrain. Also, like thinking about moving your models and the shapes and stuff, like I often I'm always looking, especially within Impassable and Garrisons. It's not just about like having a string of dudes that touch one bit of terrain on the left and then go and touch the other bit of terrain on the right. You can make more use of your units because there's always a 3-inch channel, a four inch channel
that
your opponent's models can't get through. So, you know, creating shapes to block up the board or block up an objective, or even things like, oh, my opponent's got a Vampire Lord on Zombie Dragon. Like, there's no point in just putting a straight screen in front of that if you want to try and protect your stuff behind, if you're double screening or something. Like, making it a T-shape or a weird shape to then just stop the Vampire Lord just flying over and landing behind you. Mm-hmm. Especially in the late game, I don't know if you guys probably, there's loads of occurrences when you're playing that it's more about, like, everyone's down to their last few pieces, and it's about stopping your opponent going where they want to go. So being like, oh, your shark, let's say, that's a 14-inch move, so I'm going to measure the back of its base. You know, it can't land in this position, so that means it can't then shoot my hero that I'm trying to protect that's cowering behind a herdstone on the other side of the board. So amending the shape of your units when you move them based on the purpose of that unit is key. You know, like you don't want to give, sometimes you don't want to give a huge frontage so that they get loads of their big based models coming and hitting you, like, I don't know, let's say some horrors, for example, especially stuff on a 50 mil base with a 1-inch range, 1-inch weapon. You don't want a huge frontage so that they just come in and blow you up. You want to maybe have a little cloud or a little tight pack then, because it's serving the purpose of blocking them, but not giving them loads of attacks. But then in other occasions, you might want to string that unit out as far as possible, because you're just looking to deny board position with it. So
perfect.
All shapes available.
All shapes, all sizes is the answer.
I think what some people don't, what many people still don't do is if your opponent has flying units, is that you always tend, if you do a cloud, you always tend to do, oh, the models are together, right? They're like in base contact with each other, or at least like half an inch. But if your opponent has flying units, like if you play against IDK or stuff like that, or in general, what's stopping you from just creating so much board space with just them? So doing one, the time is stopping you, but you could basically cover lots of space if you even not just the front, if you do everything exactly one inch apart, stopping your opponent from placing stuff there and are tagging you in this way as well. So for example, when I want to tag something with the spawn, if there's no place to position my model because my opponent did this, then it doesn't work, right? So I think you can optimize so much just by how your formation is of this unit.
By the stick, inch wide stick, so you can put it down rather than having to measure.
One thing as well,
you made me think of as well is, like, for example, my unit of 30 Ungol Raiders, and talking about positioning of your command models like we talked about earlier, I used to do this with the old 4-up rally Zangor blobs, is I'll always have my three command units at least like 4 inches back from the front. My command models will be 4 inches back from the front. So you know then they're going to send in a Bloodthirster who's got 8 attacks, 2s, 2s, D3 damage. It's not mathematically possible. Well, it is mathematically possible, but it's very unlikely they're going to do over like 20-something damage. So I'm always going to be left with those command models back. They rally on 5, so I'm going to take all of my, even stuff like, you know, turning off Inspiring Presence within 3, have your command models at the back so that you take all your casualties, you're out of combat, you can still Inspiring Presence them, and then regardless of whether you get the turn or not, you're then going to be rolling like 24 dice or something, 20 dice on 5s to rally them back into another formation. You know that you can maintain your units when you're moving them and positioning your heroes, so your command models within them.
Same applies, I think, to shooting, because if your opponent, if you have like one frontage and your opponent shoots from there, you take, and he has multiple shooting units, like KO, for example, right? The boat shoots, you take away the front models, and then the rest can't shoot sometimes anymore, right?
Yeah.
So then you want to string, you don't want a cloud, but it really depends on your opponent, right?
Yeah,
or like stringing to deny board movement, but you know that half of the models are going to be lost from the first shooting attack. So you take the models away and then you hide the rest behind the wildwood that you've strung out from behind of. And the possibilities are like reading the
endless
battlefield.
Possibilities,
as Darren says, like, you know, reading the battlefield from early, like, again, setting the board up. I set up my, if I get the opportunity to, I set the wildwoods up in an interesting way. Sometimes it gives my opponent, like, say, Big War recently, I played against them. I gave my opponent Wildwood in their deployment zone so that they knew then that I wanted him to put all his characters in there. So he put his Wurgog in, and that meant that I could yeet in my 6 Minotaurs, and then his Wurgog couldn't actually see out of his own Wildwood to stare me off. Manipulating your opponent with the...
Just on top of that visualization, I'm not sure if Darren approves of this sort of thing, but that sort of stopping and thinking, where is everything going to be in the next 10, 15 minutes? I found if you watch some of the various content creator YouTube channels, like Season of War, shout out to those guys. You pause it just after they've deployed and then try and visualize where you think everything's going to be.
Why would I not condone that? That's fantastic.
In two, three turns. You actually find that you, well, I found, that you actually get better and better at it
the more
you're just watching. It's actually quite a useful tool to use their YouTube reports to then see if you can predict where it's all going to go.
Do something again and again, and you get better at it, Alex. Yeah. Fucking hell, that's remarkable.
Right. We've actually answered every question, so thank you, everyone, for sending those in. I guess the last bit we want to do is top tips.
I've got a couple of things that I think are important with
moving. Okay, please. Yeah, go for it.
I know they're not question-based. So first of all, pay attention to the order you move things in, because think about your opponent's redeploys. You know, you've got this big hard character and you've got this little skirmishing unit. You know, if you move your character first, then they might redeploy. Did you want that? Do you want to use the unit first to try and trap them off? You know, that's a very small play, but I think it's a sort of thing that good players do and poor players don't do, let's say. So think about the order you're moving things in, where you can prevent people redeploying. Also, if it's your opponent's turn, think about at what point do I want to redeploy? That's a really important redeploy is really, really important. So in their movement phase, already identify where the optimal redeployment is before they've even started their movement phase. So be thinking about it. You know,
as well, Darren, is if they ever offer you a redeploy, don't fucking take it
because they put the model down and go, you're going to do anything? Wink, wink. No, I'm not. Absolutely. So, yeah, so the order you move stuff in is super important. The order and at the beginning of your opponent's movement phase, you should already know where the optimal redeploy is for yourself and at what point you're going to trigger it. So make that decision before it happens. And, you know, you can... there's loads of time to think within your opponent's turn when they're going through their hero phase. So be thinking that far ahead earlier. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then tabletop movement sort of etiquette. Like at the beginning of the game, one of the things that I will discuss with my opponent now is I really hate wobbly tape measure. So people that put their tape measures above the models and that from their viewpoint, they're moving within. But even if they get an extra half inch, that could give you an extra one on the dice to get in. And it fucking matters. So put your fucking tape measure on the table. So no fast tape measure movements. And the moment you notice it, act on it. You're not being rude. You're not a bad gamer. You've noticed your opponent has done something you think's not great. Rather than wait two or three turns, by then it's had an impact on the game. Yeah. By then, now you resent them. Now you're frustrated with them. If you just have that nice, gentle, like, can we just slow down the movement a bit? You're going a bit quick. Do it the moment you notice it. And on the flip side of that, if your opponent notices you, be absolutely fine with it because you've probably made a mistake as well because you're only fucking human. But be very movement matters. Sloppy movement is no good for either of you. And the moment you notice it, address it. Because you'll just end up resenting it. And imagine at the end of the game, you'd be like, oh, that fucker got an extra inch on me, and that really mattered. You know, that's no... You
might play a right pedant like me, and I'll be all salty.
I think to just circumvent that or to just, stop that, always be very vocal, I think, in it. So before you even touch your model, just measure beforehand. Okay, we are, I don't know, 28 inches away. I move 10. So that's 18 inches away, stuff like that. So I can shoot you, or we are less than 8. We are 17.8, and you pre-measure everything. So it doesn't even if you because it's sometimes stressful for yourself if you have to move your 30 models each exactly 10 inches, like by a millimeter. And it depends what player you play. If your opponent is a bit salty, as soon as one more shoots. Because it is important. The one guy who shoot could kill your hero, which can win the game. So
it's only a couple of extra attacks. No, fuck off.
Yeah, so be vocal about it beforehand, before the thing happens. Especially if you try to charge somewhere and you want to pile in, or maybe your opponent has a screen and you notice there's a space that is, for example, where you didn't screen off properly against your 2-inch weapon. There's like, because what people sometimes do is they screen, but they are not aware that that bases are actually a bit rounded. So sometimes with the tip, you can get somewhere in and you notice it, then measure this beforehand see, and you can tell him, look, this is 2 inches. Yes, you can be a bit of a dick and don't tell him and then just catch him out. That is possible. If you're so sure about everything, maybe it is impossible. Maybe it is important in this case. But usually I just go with the way I tell them, look, if I charge there, I can reach, correct? And they.
If it's a competitive game, though, you're not being a dick. Like, yeah, if it's a nice casual game.
I think it depends how close it is. If it's like, if you measure and you're sure it's 1.9.5, like it's super close, then you should rather, yeah, just get a judge or something.
Don't argue, but, judge immediately.
Yeah, but I think in general, be vocal about stuff. And when you screen, like when I played you, Owen, at Worlds, when we played, we were very vocal about, okay, I moved this far up, so my heroes are like 18 inches or not, more than 9 inches behind my screen, so you cannot shoot them with your 18 inches if you land 9 inches away. Stuff like that. And if you are this vocal, the game is just smoother.
So it's more enjoyable, right?
And it's way more enjoyable. And both players can play more accurate as well.
You may come across attitudes like, oh, I didn't realize we're having that sort of game. Or, oh, I didn't, you know, you're a tryhard. The bare minimum, even if you're playing narrative, like the bare minimum is that you play the fucking rules.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, that's the bare minimum of sportsmanship.
One thing I picked up, Darren, is from the Danes, actually, and I really like it. And it's like any model. Okay, my unit of Ungor, they move 7, and I'm going to auto 6 them, so they're going to move 13. They don't get the +1 because that would be cheap.
Yeah.
So I will mark 13. I'll be like, right, this is as far as I'm going to move. And if I tweak, I'm always going to be tweaking backwards because that's it. But this is my mark, my 3-inch mark down on the table.
Yeah, this is the potential.
This is the potential, not that kind of move and then a few little
things back.
All that. I don't mind a little bit of tweak, but I will only ever tweak backwards. And that's a nice tip. And another one I saw, I think it was Dennis from the Swedish team at Six Nations recently. You could tell he did it all the time. And like his pigs, I think pigs move 9 inches, right?
Mm.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I nodded like I knew then. No fucking idea.
He would do this thing where he would put the back of his 9-inch marker right on the front of the unit of pigs. And then he would like basically drop the 9-inch gauge down and then rock it up. So it was then sitting like vertically on the table. And then that's when he would be moving his models and they would literally hit the front of his gauge every time. So he had this kind of rhythmic thing where he was constantly like putting the guy down, like the 9-inch marker down, rocking it up, and then moving the model to perfectly butt to it. And like you could tell that he just played all his games like that, and it was one of the cleanest games of Warhammer I've seen from a movement perspective, just because there was never any ambiguity around how he was moving.
Great.
Well, and if you do that, you encourage your opponent to do that
exactly, right?
You lead by example, right?
Yeah. Totally.
Right. Let's do some top tips, biggest mistakes. We'll go round. In fact, Owen, let's start with you as you're just talking. Top tips or biggest mistakes for movement?
State your intention at all times. Get a load of 9-inch markers out and be like, for me, it's super important with beasts. I'm like, I'm not triggering a redeploy anywhere on this table. So I will just put the markers out. And then, clear intent on movement. Just from a list writing perspective in terms of movement, then like choose. I always, now that we're really into the edition, people are fucking good at the game and they know what their army does and they know how to get all their battle tactics. So putting in units that have specific roles, like your Furies in your Khorne for that turn one battle tactic, or I basically write lists now where I'll take things and their movement characteristic and their base size is more important than any of their output or some cool spell or the way they synergize with something else. So prioritizing movement in the list writing stage, I would say there's a couple of tips that I might have.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. Darren, top tip, biggest mistake.
If you're playing at a tournament where there's preset terrain, always get to the table before any fucker, right? Because that stops people cheating and moving the terrain to their advantage. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, measure between pieces of terrain. So you've got like a mental map. And this is a bit counterintuitive to what Owen said there, always sort of state your intent, etc. Sometimes you want to hide your intent. So the more you're measuring, the more you're that signaling to your opponent, that model's going to end up there eventually. So if you've got an idea of how far pieces of scenery are apart, and you know that this castle between this point and this point is 19 inches, and I've got a 6-inch move, I'm now going to be 13 inches from there. You don't have to measure it. So that can just, so you don't signal to your opponent, that's where you're going to try and end up. See, it's, I think that's maybe something that I pay a bit more attention to than the most.
Yeah, I know what you mean. You're trying to not tell people what you're going to do, basically.
Yeah, so play to intent, but not to the point where you're signaling what you're going to be doing. You know, you want to try and you want to keep some mystery. You know, like when you're wooing a lady or a bloke.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And get a mystery.
Perfect. And is that your mistake, Darren, or is that
my mistake? No. Oh, what is my mistake with movement? Just not addressing sloppy movement immediately. Like, I see it so many times, like, oh, he just kept doing it. Why don't you fucking tell him or them? Like, why don't you tell them the moment you notice it? Because if someone gets away with something, like say they are dodgy and they get away with it, that emboldens them to keep doing it. Like, if you signal, like, please stop moving quickly, stop using your floaty tape measure, stop pulling it out and then putting it back before I can even check what you're saying, then that's going to prevent them. You're signaling you're paying attention. So they're going to be, you know, less naughty in the future.
Yeah.
So be aware, pay as much attention to your own movement as your opponents.
Toby, top tip, biggest mistake.
So, got any? So top tip, I would say I'm building on top of what Darren said with this being mysterious about your move. I think sometimes if you know you're playing a very good player, he's in your head already because he knows your army as well, right? He knows what to play. He knows how to counter it. He knows your tricks. So what is the best then? You do the, like the battle tactics, say, bait and traps. You actually bait him sometimes into things that he does. So you sometimes bait that you made a mistake, but in reality, it's not a mistake. It's you bait him in. So that is probably a top tip. That is very dangerous, though. Always
that's
very be aware.
That's very satisfying. Satisfying when it works, isn't it? Got
you. Yeah, it is very dangerous, but... Yeah, so I did this in the past.
Sometimes you have to play unexpectedly, don't you?
Yes,
you do. If everyone's sound and the dice are average, you've got to make something happen. Certainly, if you're behind in the matchup as well.
So if you have a player like Alex who wants to punish mistakes, you purposefully do something that seems like a mistake, and then you blizzard his turtle off turn two.
Oh, Toby, you'd smash me. I'd fall straight into it. I'd be right in there. I'd be right in there, and you just, yeah, exactly.
Send it.
Great. And any mistakes at all, Toby? Top mistake? You see people making a lot?
I've got two things. So first of all, think of the battle plan a lot, because it changes the game massively, how you deploy, how you do everything. So deep deployment, for example, changes it massively. Don't say, oh, this is a bad matchup before you don't even know which battle plan you're playing. Because you can win against any army if the battle plan is good for you or if the bad for them, right? So, and I think the other one is something that even good players sometimes do. Just because you can do the movement, like we've talked about all of this, just because you can do it doesn't mean you always should. Well, that's just something I played recently, just a test game, and then I bloodbinded something, and then after the bloodbind, because I wasn't I didn't measure it out before, and I made the mistake there, right, of not doing what I tell people to do, and then suddenly my pieces couldn't move around the screen around his screen that I wanted to push away so I can charge over them, but my bases were too big and I couldn't move around it, so I had this movement shenanigan that I use, which was actually quite bad to use in this case. Just because if you roll the 12-inch charge, don't always take it. Don't even roll it, even if you want to know if it would go, because then you have to make a tough decision that you wouldn't even do otherwise. So it's not part of your game plan. Just because you have
Toby, to... would you say don't get too excited?
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah, I think so.
You got it in, Alex.
Right. Well, that leads me on to our final section, which obviously is Darren's favourite section. So please, Darren.
The plays!
Thank you very much. So this is the plays / misplays section. Who would like to go first?
Can I tell you how Owen ripped my guts out?
Please.
I don't know what you're going to say here, Darren. So
we're playing an exhibition game at the LGT, right? And I went into it thinking, oh, this will be a lovely, friendly game. So sat down at lunch with Owen, explained my army through and through. And he's sitting there. He's like, oh, yeah, okay, brilliant. Brilliant. And he tells me a couple of his tricks. And then we play the game and he absolutely rinses me. And it's this, so I hadn't really figured out. I've only really played against 9 balls before. And I hadn't done the mental arithmetic. And this is probably something that's really simple for Beastmen players. I imagine this is a play that they do all the time, but I hadn't seen it. And I've probably heard about it as well, but hearing something and experiencing it are two different things. So there's a situation where I've crammed all my Stormcasts into the middle of the board and I want to win turn 2 priority and force Owen to come onto the board. But that doesn't happen. Owen wins a priority and obviously he gives it away. So I do fuck all. Of course he does.
For the listeners, Owen is punching the air right now. Just so you
he's got, there's scenery all around and I've got like, there's a rock here, 2 rocks to the side and a rock here. So there's
like north, south, east, west, basically.
Yeah, right? Correct. Yeah. So I've got a situation where I've got some like liberators blocking up one place, some tempesters blocking up another, bastion in another. And I'm like trying to encourage him to come in. And I'm thinking if I win the priority, then I'm going to shoot him with 9 long strikes and it's going to be a great game. And what I don't notice is that the terrain is like they're like rocks. So like they bulb us out and then they go in right at the bottom. So I've moved up my liberators. Oh, liberators and judicators, actually. And Owen comes down and he attacks both sides. And where this is important, his base can get under the piece of scenery. I hadn't noticed it, and Owen had. It's a fair play. I could have simply moved my models closer to it. And it meant that he could get within an inch of my liberators with both units of his balls. Mm. And obviously he does enough mortal wounds to kill them. Yeah. And then he gets his... lead cow to then charge in the charge phase into my long strikes, and it just absolutely guts me. He takes like 800 points out, and I hadn't seen it, and I was livid. Owen didn't tell me to watch out for it, though. Bear in mind, we're about to play a lovely game. He's just taking the piss out of me here. I was like, I gave him everything. He's just fucking. Oh, that's handy. That's good knowledge, Darren. Right. Bang.
I think I told you everything I could do, Darren.
You didn't know. You smashed me. Fair play. You saw that like minutia, and I didn't. So that's, I've got no problem with it. I don't like fucking losing, and I don't like losing that badly. I did think I brought it back because right at the end I could have drawn with him if I made an 11-inch charge and killed this big unit. And I rolled the dice and I rolled a 7. So I got under the table and threw the dice backwards and heard everyone gasp because now we've got a crowd. And I hit the fucking 11 and I get up and Owen's face is fucking thunder. there's like a 3% chance Darren's going to draw and he's fucking livid. Long story short, Owen beat me.
but then we had the same matchup, table 5 at Coventry, and you...
I learnt a lot. I mean, I got... Oh, on that note, I had the luckiest game I've had ever against Owen. From turn 2 onwards, there was a point where Owen went, right, I'm going to use these Swedish and something else dice to do my charges. And I went, oh, you know I fucking hate special dice. And he went, oh, I'm going to do it. He rolled an 11 and a double 6. And I was fuming. I was like, fucking butt, I can't believe he's done this to me. And from that, and Owen went... And rightly so. No, Darren, I'm a nice guy. And I was like, yeah, of course you are. But he did pick me up on being a salty fucker. And then from that moment onwards, everything I did was beautiful. Everything. To the point where I forgot to... Owen's battle tactic was kill 3 long strikes. Okay. And his plan was to jump across with his 30 guys, shoot them and then charge in. And I've forgotten to rally. So Owen went, okay, it's not, the game's not progressed. He very kindly offered to let me rally. Oh no, sorry, I had four long strikes and there was two to go. So he let me rally out of sequence, which is very kind of him. Bear in mind, it's going to be difficult and this is his battle tactic. So then I roll the dice. The first one's instantly a six and the other one's spinning, to which Owen goes, oh, for fuck's sake, Darren, won't you fucking fail something? As his head comes down, the other one that's spinning lands on a six. And I had to hide it at the table. I was like, fucking hell, he's gonna kill me. And I didn't take it
back.
I didn't take it. I was like, that's too much, Owen. I'm so sorry, but everything I've done, everything was just a bit. Everything was spot on, wasn't it? Like, if it was a redeploy, it was a five. If it was a two armor saves of five plus, it was both saved. And everything Owen did failed by an inch. Yes,
it was just one of those.
Everything was just great for me. Like I say, from that moment onwards. Like someone was like, I'm going to teach you a lesson, Darren.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't. It got me to Atlanta. But yeah, it made me feel so bad that I had to get rid of a double six rally because it was just too much.
Great. Right, Owen, play, misplay.
Probably over in America, I've done quite a lot of just out of like that. It's the same play again. I don't think it's that much of a great play if I keep doing it all the time, but the Doomball command ability just has so much value. So for example, you know, you charge, you blow up a little hero that they're screening with. And, you know, I've denied unleash hells into things like big blobs of, you know, big blobs of bliss barb archers, wrapping KO boats. So not even going for the charge. Like in my list writing, I'm at 1960 generally. So I have the Bloodthirsty Triumph. Yeah. So I put my bull seven away from a KO boat that I've cleared the screen out of the way in the, you know, with the shooting from the raiders. And then, just combat phase charging, denying the overwatch. When you charge in the combat phase as well, you obviously apply the damage at the end, the impact damage. So often, you know, I'm like blowing up an Arcanaut Admiral, which happens at the end of the phase, but then putting all of the bulls into an ironclad, blowing up.
So you know where that damage has gone, so you can then put the other damage appropriately.
Yeah, and generally when I wrap, then if they don't have prudency shoots, then they haven't got enough room to jump out, like, say, a bunch of Endrin Riggers or Thunderers. The only thing they can ever really jump out is a little character, so I'll apply the impact damage to the character and then pump the boat off, and then all the dudes inside die because the boat's wrapped. So that's always
the best, isn't it, when they lose an ironclad and 15 other fuckers and you're like, you fucking KO bastard.
And then they lose the frigate the same way in the next turn. And then my misplay was taking the offer of a THC gummy at the start of round one of Everwinter and having a very spangly game of Warhammer against Sam Gould. I looked across the table at him. He was playing Seraphon and Starborn. And I was like, I'm sorry, man. I was like, I'm all over the place. And then he was like, don't worry, Owen. I've had the same gummies. We're fine.
Did the model start talking to you at any point? Did they?
Yeah, that's... Croak was just laughing at me, floating around.
He regretted painting your Seraphon in all those light colours.
Yeah.
Although at that game I did use the charge, my Doomball charged in and one banged the Slan off to deny the grand strategy, and I beat him on grand strat, so it worked. Yes,
the gummy worked. Perfect.
The gummy worked.
Toby, misplays or plays?
I guess misplays, the one I just mentioned, I think, where I pulled a unit and then it denied me more movement than it needed.
Was that automatic mode, do you think? You'd done it so many times.
I was just like, I can pull, I'm going to pull. So I do it because I can. So that was just a test game. So it wasn't that big of a deal because it wasn't on a tournament. I think... and then the other thing is that the biggest tournament here in Germany, that was a six-round tournament here, the Raccoon Rumble. And I'm not the best with hangovers, but I still went drinking, and that wasn't good because then it was after the first. So they had one game on Friday, and then so it's just one round. And then you still have, like, there was 170 people, so there was still lots of people on winning bracket. But I faced in the end the winner of the tournament. but I was still drunk almost when I got there, and we were playing on clock, on stream, everything. And of course, that didn't end up well. So I lost that game. So that was definitely a big misplay there.
So was the misplay not to continue drinking?
Probably, yeah. But
you'd have cared less.
Maybe, yeah. But the time was still a problem. Would have still been a problem. Because I chat a lot when I get drunk. So
great.
I think awesome. Best place would be, so one was at my last tournament in Luxembourg, a team tournament where I had enough summoning points to summon Bloodletters, which is usually 20 Bloodletters, usually the go-to summon for Khorne. But instead, I summoned a cannon, and that was very good because my Thirster had to kill a hero. This was the battle tactic because he slayed my general beforehand. So, but the hero was on a one-up save, so it was a bit dicey. So then I summoned the cannon, shot 4 wounds off that hero from 8. That was the guy on Karkodrak. Then charged the cannon into 2 untamed beasts that were remaining from a unit. The cannon killed the untamed beasts. Then it could shoot in the hero phase. And I killed the Chaos Sorcerer in the back line, which taught me my grand strategy with the shooting. And then later I also boomed a hero.
Then later you boomed, right? Sounds like a dreamy game.
Yeah, and then I got the cannon basically, because I get 2 blood ties from heroes, basically got his points back, the 5 summoning points right away as well.
Wow.
So that was a big play there. And I think the other one is, which is also more a community thing, is that the last big tournament I played, 2 players who were there for their first tournament and round 1 against a Gargant player. And he figured out that because I had the Germany shirt on that I was on the team. And I think he was very hell-bent on just keeping the game going for 5 rounds, just to tell his wife that he played against the captain for 5 rounds. It was a very lovely game still. Of course, he made mistakes, but that's fine. But he had a lovely game. And in the end, he killed my Scarbrand with his giant. So that was so from a narrative standpoint, it was very great for him. And there was another game that I played against a newcomer in the tournament scene. And they described it as the best game they had in the tournament, and they learned a lot. And that means a lot to me, especially in a scene that is, we're not super small, but we are still growing. So it's very important that new players have a very positive experience, especially on tournaments. And if they also learn something in addition, then it's just the best you can have, because when I look at worlds or in competition to other countries, it doesn't help me if the 8 people I choose are good, but then next year they just don't play anymore. So I want to bring the whole country forward. And if you show people that competitive can be fun, you can learn something, it is entertaining, then that's just all we need, basically.
Right,
and people get better.
Yeah, great, perfect. Right, for mine, I think, Owen, you're going to have to help me with this, because I think it'd be remiss of us not to mention our lovely Team Sweden gentleman that came up to you at the tournament and said, I think I'm too excited.
Yes.
So, Owen, do you want to do my play for me with this, with our Team Sweden friend?
God. I can't remember his name, so I'm really sorry, but he played Seraphon, and he played in a Seraphon mirror against the creator of AOS, Mo Ashraf, who is our Seraphon player on the world.
Shout out, Mo, to creator of AOS. Thank you very much for all your service. Yep.
And he basically the Swedish player effectively had turn 1, did a load of damage, and then Mo didn't screen out as well as he would have wanted to, and his opponent saw an in and just teleported Croak into the middle of the army and just blew everything up doing silly Croak things. And then stopped me after the game and just said that he couldn't help himself because he got too excited. But if you get too excited, then you sometimes get a 20-0. Sometimes you immediately lose, but he put himself in a position, and he felt like he had to tell me that, which was great.
So there you go. The moral of the story is sometimes getting too excited is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
So, on that note, if you listen and anything resonates with you and it helps, do let us know because it makes us feel great.
Yeah, please do. It's actually really nice to hear from people that they've either done something or done a tip or made the same mistake or whatever. Actually, it's really nice to hear because then it helps us kind of record better episodes for you guys.
Keep going.
Exactly. So that's it for our Christmas cast episode. God, I nearly buggered it up there. So all that's left for me to say is, Toby, thank you very much for coming on. That was awesome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so thank you very much. And thank you for all those wonderful tips. I'll be listening back myself. Owen, Darren, thank you as always. Pleasure. And have a lovely Christmas. And to all of you guys listening, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for kind of joining us on this kind of podcast journey and listening to us this year. It's been absolutely amazing. I think Owen wants to say something very quickly.
The Swedish player's name was Abbe. There we go.
So shout out to Abbe. I was trying to find it on Twitch.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Abbe. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt.
As I said to all the listeners, thank you for all your messages. Thank you for all your really kind comments. We do all appreciate it. So all that's left for me to say is Merry Miss Carstmas. Have a lovely new year. And
Merry
be Miss kind. Time. Look after each other. And we'll catch you all next time. So cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.